Good morning. Welcome to EXL 321A. This morning we'll talk about virtualization with Link 2013. Just as a reminder, we haven't had a lot of our evals filled out yet for the track, so if you guys have been going to some Exchange or Link sessions the past few days, or sessions in general, I should say, if you could take some time for those, we'd appreciate it. We do actually keep track of all those. One point is, as speakers, we do actually read all of your comments, so if you have positive or negative feedback, we try to incorporate that. The track owners also do incorporate that. And as a secondary one, internally, right, we tend to compete among the tracks, so if you're going to the Exchange and Link tracks, we like to beat the other tracks for that one. So we take your feedback and hopefully do a better job, and we try to win, but so primary point, right, we do value your feedback and record it, and secondary one, we always try to do a better job than the other ones, and hopefully that competition makes for some interesting topics and interesting speakers as you guys come out. So thanks for your assistance there. This morning, we're going to talk about virtualization in Link. We'll start out covering the hardware planning portions around that, and then we'll spend about 45 minutes to an hour going over guidance that we have, both a combination of what's supported and not supported, as well as what's really we focused on in this one is around recommendations that we've learned from virtualizing workloads such as Exchange and Link over the past 5 to 7 years, both at Microsoft and from customers in the field. What you're seeing has not been presented at a tech ed prior. We've developed this over the past 6 months or so, just in general from questions that customers and partners have asked us. So what I'd like to do for this one is usually we take questions at the end to kind of keep flow and make sure our timing is accurate. But in this case, we'd like to take questions live. So if you have questions on some of the content, raise your hand. I'll repeat it and go through it. And we'll try to make this one a little bit more dynamic than you know the phrase I'm looking for, interactive, than we typically see on some of the sessions. So with that, let's go ahead and show you some guidance on planning and sizing your Link 2013 environment, specifically around the virtualization aspect. With Link 2013, if you're coming from a Link 2010 environment, there were some core architectural changes. The big ones here are that we've tried to simplify the server deployment model to be fewer servers. A lot of our feedback from the versions of Office Communication Server and Link 2010 was to deploy Link and to have all that functionality required a large server count. And so either you're deploying a large number of physical servers or a large number of virtual guests, that becomes complex to manage. There's questions then around how do you size and plan and numbers of these different roles. So with Link 2013, and as server capacity has increased from a hardware perspective, we tried to co-locate as many of these servers or services onto as fewer servers as possible. Another question that we get is that Microsoft, right, you release a product like Office Communication Server 2007 R1, and you have this option for expanded or co-located topology, and then in 2007 R2, you change that model again and you add some roles, and in Link 2010, you have these different roles, and what's the guidance or why sometimes you have these different roles and why sometimes is there a concept of co-located or separation of roles? The summary answer to that is that we plan in the Exchange and Link product groups to target a specific hardware chassis. Typically that's a 2U or a two-socket 2U server with some local storage and some memory, because that's the most cost-effective commodity server to purchase. And so in general, most organizations are buying a server of that hardware platform. So we know what a 2U server does from a CPU perspective, right? If we go back 6 or 7 years, that might have been a couple or one or two cores per CPU. Now we're seeing, you know, hex cores, 8 cores, et cetera, going forward. So what we are able to do with the code base is sort of align what we can run effectively on that hardware platform or with that number or amount of CPU cycles available to us. And so when we have more services than can fit on that standard 2U socket, we will have additional roles in the Link and Exchange environments for you. When we have enough CPU capacity to co-locate that, we prefer to co-locate that. In general, we like to have a larger number of identical servers rather than subsets of dedicated server roles, because you have higher availability. So if you have, for example, let's say 4 servers to choose from, right, and we have roles A and B, in that one. In the link case, you could say front ends and back ends, or let's say front ends and AV MCUs, for example. And all four are identical. We can lose half of those servers, but the server stays functional. If we have server types A and B, and we split those four servers into two of A and two of B, and we lose 50% of our capacity, and those both happen to be A, we've lost functionality in the service. So in general, when we're planning, we like to have a larger number of these co-located brick-type server model as we deploy them, and that ensures that as we lose some of these bricks in the service, or in the from the resource perspective, right, the actual service stays up and available for end users. So with 2013, we've brought back the AV MCU onto these servers. We know that we have enough CPUs when we're targeting the commodity servers that are shipping today. We've co-located the XMPP gateway. We don't need you to deploy in your perimeter network, right, an additional type of role for talking to XMPP-based systems. The XMPP communications and link will flow through the link edge servers and the link front-end servers that you've already deployed. And this is encompassing the fact that we've actually increased CPU utilization on Link itself. So we've added things like multi-party HD video, right? These are very high CPU intensive operations. However, our testing has shown, and we'll show you the hardware specs that we tested against in a moment, that using that hardware platform and having all these services co-located will still provide an optimal end user experience for Link functionality. From a back-end perspective, previous versions of Link, so Link 2010, OCS 2007, R2, and prior, did a lot of work leveraging SQL to do the management and storage and repository of functionality for user services in Link. So if we had our contact lists and presence, for example, that was all flowing from the status that was being stored back in SQL. What this means is that that SQL backend repository is a single point of failure, right? And so we had options such as SQL clustering in the past. With Link 2013, we tend to recommend, or we recommend SQL mirroring. We recently changed our support stance to now include SQL clustering again. But in general, we prefer mirroring because you have two independent copies of SQL, right? If the storage and SQL box fail on one side, the other copy is available and is up and running. However, what we want to do also is de-emphasize that reliance on a single point of failure. So we're moving a lot of the functionality that required SQL onto the front ends itself. All Link servers have a copy of the central management store stored in SQL Express. And so we have this database capacity on the nodes. And so by moving some of that functionality off to the front ends, we decrease our reliability on SQL. And so with Link 2013, we can have some momentary outages on the backend server, and we'll still provide the end user experience because they can register to front ends and we can cache that information while they continue to operate. So goal being, we want to have this concept of bricks, right? Lots of identically configured servers, all running services. We'll use software to replicate the information or move that between them, and therefore we can have outages of any one of these particular platforms, but still maintain that concept of service availability. Scalability-wise, we've increased the scalability from the front-end server perspective from an enterprise edition. We're up to about 6,500 users per front-end in an enterprise edition pool. From a standard edition, though, that's decreased from the 5,000 down to about 2,500. And that's due essentially to running more services on that front-end server and specifically moving some of those back-end SQL services onto the front-end itself. And so having that higher utilization on those reduces the overall count of end users that we can retain on that. One of the other recommendation items we have around enterprise edition pools is around this concept of the Windows Fabric and how the Quora model works there. Due to that, we tend to recommend that you have at least three enterprise edition front-end servers in any pool to maintain Quorum. We support one or two enterprise edition front-end servers in the pool, but for optimal availability purposes, the minimum number essentially on front-end pools now is up to three servers. So knowing that there's this background of, yes, we've expanded out the number of servers that are required, or number of roles that are required, and then we tried to bring those back in as the hardware catches up with the user demands, right? Let's take a look at how we then would deploy, how we would deploy Link in an organization like this. We do have the hardware specifications listed out on TechNet. I put them here in the slides for summary purposes, but it's also to highlight this concept of two sockets, right? Two CPU sockets. Typically, we're saying a hex core CPU or higher is what we're using as our base sizing for that user model that we defined out on TechNet. So if you're using the user model of all functionality, right? Instant messaging, conferencing, audio and video conferencing, and some percentage of those being HD quality ones, using these server platforms, you will be able to get to the numbers supported that we're providing outside in our guidance. So same concept, right? A little bit higher capacity there for the backend server roles, for our director monitoring, archiving, and edge servers. We've reduced that a little bit. Now we're at 2 gigahertz, right? And we can go down to a 2 quad core or 2 dual core servers on that versus the hex core requirements for the front end servers and back end servers. So knowing what our server physical capacity ones are, the first question that people typically have is, how do we size this for a virtual environment? And they typically want to go into, I'm going to have a guest that's going to be sized, and so I need to plan for the guest sizing. Our recommendations is that when you're doing virtualization or sizing for virtualization, you size the virtual guests exactly the same as you would size for physical, because we don't have, Link is not aware that it's going to be running virtual or physical, and so it's asking for some amount of CPU, some amount of RAM, some amount of NIC, and some amount of storage. So we have guidance for you on the physical side of how to extrapolate a user model and Link towards one of those models. When you size for virtual, you'd use that same process, come up with your CPU, memory, NIC, and storage, and then add those up, add the overhead for your hypervisor, and now you know what your physical box needs to be able to do to host that services. This has been a point of confusion both inside and outside for a lot of organizations in terms of how to plan. There is no magic on sizing the guests, right? You take our sizing guidance for physical, size that for your guests virtual, and then add in the overhead for the hypervisor itself. For your hypervisor overhead, the question there is what percent that is, right? As a rule of thumb, we typically say 10%. We'll have some more guidance as we kind of walk through later in the deck. But it's going to vary based on who you're using for a hypervisor vendor and what specific physical hardware platform you're using. There are certain hardware platforms that are now tuned for virtualization itself and can reduce this hypervisor overhead to the 5-6% range. There are other hardware platforms that, and other combinations of hypervisors, right, that might make that as high as 10 or 11%. And so in general, you're going to see a range of what that hypervisor overhead is, and you'll add that in addition to all the guests that you have on a specific physical server when you're planning for your overall server capacity. So in what we say here, right, is contact your hypervisor vendor. They will give you explicit guidance. If you ask our Hyper-V folks, we can tell you what the overhead is for a specific hardware platform. If you ask the common third-party vendors, they'll be able to give you the same guidance. Sometimes you have to push them for that. They don't always like to mention that their hypervisor actually does take up some CPU, memory, network, et cetera, right? But in general, they will give you that if you ask the question and say you need it for your planning purposes. From a infrastructure perspective, when you're deploying Link, we do support Link on Windows 7, Windows 2008 R2, and Windows Server 2012. There are some functional requirements, right, from an Active Directory and a core components level. Active Directory needs to be at Windows Server 2003 or later. That's typically not an issue. It's been a long time since I've seen an org that has a domain or forest functional level that's pre-2003, but we do also support you all the way up through Windows Server 2012 from a domain and forest functional level perspective. We mentioned the, if you're aware, right, in Link 2010, we introduced the concept of DNS load balancing, which is not to be confused with DNS round robin. This is a way that Link clients can use to gather the number of servers in a pool and then randomly choose per client level the sequence or order of servers to talk to. This is correct from the SIP perspective and registration perspective, but the clients also use Link Web Services to talk to those front-end servers. We will automatically do load balancing among the servers in the pool from the SIP perspective, but we do not automatically do load balancing from the HTTP or HTTPS perspective. So when we deploy pools of servers, we do recommend a hardware load balancer for the web services aspect. But from the client registration and the client SIP perspective, we'll have automatic load balancing there via the DNS load balancing capability. This is the same process for Link 2010 as for Link 2013, so no changes there. We do have a link right for you if you're looking for the list of hardware load balancers that have provided guidance around Link. There's a link there on TechNet for you to go out and take a look at that. There are also the common hardware load balancer vendors all by now have provided software equivalents, so you can run a virtual machine with the load balancing functionality from Hyper-V, from F5, for example, right, or NetScaler, and have that actually run in a VM versus run as a dedicated physical appliance. So let's get a little bit more specific on the virtualization aspect itself. We support all workloads in Link 2013 to be virtualized. So in the past, we had some issues around some of the codecs, specifically the voice and video codecs. If we go back 4 or 5 years ago, most hypervisors did not have a way to prioritize traffic and allow that prioritized traffic at the network interface to rapidly get CPU attention or processor time. As a result, when we virtualized earlier versions of Link, or of OCS, for example, on these earlier hypervisors, we would see staccato audio or drop packets and sort of a degraded audio or video experience. Since this time period, right, especially over the last several years, all modern hypervisors have the capacity of ensuring that the processor is going to get priority time for priority traffic hitting a network interface, and so we don't have this issue with audio and video that we had in the past. As a result, it doesn't matter if you're virtualizing Link to do IAM and presence, voice, web conferencing, or video, all the functionality is supported. So whether you're deploying the Link front-end servers, edge roles, right, persistent chat, or SQL, we fully support all those roles to be virtualized. From a hypervisor perspective, we support Windows 2008 R2 or later. We obviously would recommend Windows Server 2012 or Hyper-V version 3, as that has some significant improvements. We'll talk a little bit about that later. From the guest and host level, as well as VMware ESX5 or later, and or any hypervisor that's on the SVVP, or Server Virtualization Validation Program. The SVVP is essentially the hardware compatibility list for hypervisors, right? So if we buy a server from a vendor that has 2, 3, or 4 letters in their name, we know that Windows is going to work on that server because Microsoft has an established support framework with all the hardware vendors. Those vendors submit their hardware. We go through testing in the hardware compatibility list. If there's a bug in the BIOS or firmware or drivers, we can work with that vendor behind the scenes to escalate and prioritize that and get that resolved. When hypervisors first started shipping, we now have a software shim between that hardware, you know, the approved hardware list, right, and Windows itself. And initially, we did not have a way to work with those hypervisor vendors to validate that if we had an issue or problem, we could go back and talk to their developers and share code back and forth. SVVP is that process. All the major hypervisor vendors are now part of the SVVP or Server Virtualization Validation Program, and so therefore we can support applications such as Link or Windows running on top of a virtualization vendor that is part of SVVP. As we pointed out, we use the hardware recommendations and hardware planning guidance to plan whether we're planning virtual or physical. So we're planning, we're sizing for, as I call it, a Link instance, right? So we go through our planning, we figure out that we need X number of servers or X instances, then we can make the decision, should those instances be physical or should they be virtual? If they're physical, we go out and procure the physical hardware required for them. If they're virtual, we request guests with those physical, where with those instance characteristics, right? Number of CPUs, or number of sockets, number of cores, essentially, amount of RAM, network, and storage, and then add the hypervisor overhead when we give that to the hypervisor team to ensure that we're getting that functionality as required. If we do deploy on Windows Server 2012 Hyper-V version 3, we've removed a lot of the barriers that we had logically in Windows Server 2008. So now we have support for very large number of cores. I think it's, is it 64 is the core count now in Hyper-V version 3, right? So we don't have sizing guidance even for you for Link for 64 cores. You could probably run quite a number of users on a machine that had that effective equivalent. But it, the big change, right, is we no longer have the 4 core count limit. We've also got some significant improvements around the networking stack, which will help with things such as media traffic. There are some virtualization features which are not currently supported. The common ones would be quick or live migration and VM replicas. The rationale behind that is that Link, in both the standard edition and enterprise edition capacity, has a failover mechanism built in. And so when we look at front-end servers in the enterprise pool, clients are going to attach to one of those servers either via DNS load balancing or a hardware load balancer. And we're also going to do some dynamic provisioning of things such as conferences, right? So Link servers are going to look at the number of servers in a pool and are going to dynamically instantiate conferences on the next available to sort of load balance out the load between user traffic that's going to occur on those pools. If we start looking at things such as quick and live migration and the concept of a real-time codec, what we have is an interruption in service when that device or that server is being migrated from one to another. And as a result, conferences or any sort of real-time communications go on hold or on pause during that, and we have a degraded user experience. So we haven't submitted those through testing for the quick live migration or VM replica due to the preference from Microsoft to have the Link capabilities for failover being leveraged versus the hypervisor or host capabilities for failover. One that is in process of being tested is dynamic memory. We see organizations turning on dynamic memory a lot now. On the Exchange side, we don't recommend this as the with Exchange, we leverage all available memory to reduce the amount of I/O being required. From the Link side, we're currently undergoing testing to validate whether or not we can say we support dynamic memory being turned on, and if so, some additional guidance of what your tolerances or thresholds might be within that area. Additionally, we've added virtualization support in the Link 2013 planning tool. How many people here have not seen the Link 2010 or the Link 2013 planning tool? Awesome. So the planning tool is useful from a firewall, namespace, server count perspective. It tends to estimate conservatively based on the numbers and sizing. So when you walk through the planning tool, expect that it's probably going to be slightly over-provisioned because every time we have a choice, right, we fall on the caution side. And so if you add that up 5 or 10 times throughout the planning tool process or the decisions that you're making, you end up getting a lot of buffer overhead. So as you take the planning tool output, you'll probably want to revalidate going through the TechNet sizing exercises to ensure that your server counts are required. You might be one or two servers over-provisioned from the planning tool. However, what it's very useful for is going in and providing your names and IP addresses for the server instances that you have. The planning tool does an excellent job of providing all of your firewall requirements from the perimeter network side, as well as load balancing, certificate names, DNS registrations, and other aspects. So from the DNS certificate and firewall planning exercises, the planning tool does an excellent job. From a sizing perspective, if you like to be extra conservative and safe, it will give you some excellent numbers. If you want to be a little bit more cost efficient, right, you might want to revisit the output there to determine if the multiple safe choices that we made during the decision process there leads to the actual numbers that you need from a capacity perspective. The other piece around virtualization is, I started the session and we instantly assume when we talk about virtualization, we're talking about server virtualization, right? Server virtualization is the one we're most familiar with. This is where we can have multiple guests running on a single physical box or maybe multiple physical boxes if we've got a cluster in our hypervisor environment. But essentially enabling multiple workloads or multiple guests on a single specific or physical server. However, there are some other virtualization aspects or discussions to have as well. The other ones relevant to Link, right, would be the concept of application, session, and VDI. Application virtualization is where we can take the application and stream it out to user desktops. So from a Microsoft perspective, we bought the AppV technology. If you're deploying an application with AppV, we're streaming the application out to the desktop versus installing it locally with an MSI. In the past, almost all of our software was installed via that concept of an MSI and a distribution software mechanism such as System Center. However, we've received a lot of feedback from organizations that that's a time-consuming, there's a lot of overhead, there's patches and updates that have to be applied, and it takes a significant amount of time for an organization to deploy that way. We have seen, both from Microsoft and some third parties, right, the concept of application virtualization. And from a Microsoft Office 365 perspective, we're leveraging application virtualization for Office 2013. So we've seen this as an easier way, right? We can push out or stream the copy of Office to your desktops. And when we provide patches or updates, we do that centrally, and those updates will automatically flow to individual clients themselves. We do support the Link client via the application virtualization method. So if you license Office 2013 from Office 365, right, that can include the Link client. Or you could deploy the Link client yourself leveraging application virtualization. The other two ones are how you virtualize at the client level. There are sort of two aspects or two themes around that. One is called session virtualization. This is the classic terminal services scenario. So you have a terminal server, you have software such as Office or Link installed on that terminal server, and users will remote in, right, and run a session, which is dynamic, loaded live, and then closed down when they log off. That allows them to run the software that you've installed in that session itself. With that, we do support some capabilities in Link. We'll kind of walk through what those are. The other client virtualization method is called VDI, or virtualized desktop. In a virtualized desktop, a user has a desktop environment cached or stored on the server itself, right? So when they log in, they have their own unique instance. Software that's installed in that VDI environment is not necessarily installed in the next user's VDI environment, right? So it's different from the concept of session, because instead of installing Office once on the terminal server, you would be installing Office uniquely inside of each VDI environment. And so there's two ways to sort of virtualize at the client perspective, the concept of session virtualization and VDI differentiate between those. All right, so the next couple slides talk about the pros and cons of virtualization. And we could summarize it as this. If you say, Andrew, or if you ask someone at Microsoft, should I virtualize my environment? We don't have a simple yes or no answer, right? There's advantages and disadvantages to both approaches. So from a benefit side, there are some obvious benefits. I won't even ask the question. My assumption here is that everyone in the room has some level of virtualization inside of their organization. Virtualization effectively allows you to have more resources running on less hardware, right? So you're able to share resources in the environment. Therefore, you're able to reduce your physical or capital spend to run your organization. It's very rare these days to come across an organization that has expanding budgets. Most organizations have less money to spend each year, but have more demands placed on the organization, right? So increase the level of service, but reduce the level of spend. Virtualization has effectively enabled that over the last several years for the typical organization. There's other benefits besides cost. As we look at the Microsoft 2U model, right? If we filled your data centers with lots of 2U servers, we consume a lot of space and power. The same vendors that are selling you a 2U server can probably sell you a 4 or 5U server that might have 64 cores in it, a terabyte of RAM, and can run lots of different VMs, but takes up the space of two or three of these 2U servers, right? So from a data center footprint perspective, doing server virtualization allows you to reduce the number of physical chassis, therefore reducing your power, cooling, lease costs, floor costs, et cetera, on side of that. There's advantages around just deploying or provisioning systems, right? So typically it's faster to purchase a smaller number of these higher capacity servers and then provision instances for the applications you wish to run. So if you want to run 20 Link instances, you request 20 guests from your hypervisor farm, right? And you'll have those available probably within hours or a day or two, versus if you had to request 20 physical servers, you're going through a capital process and it takes days, weeks, or months to go through that process. And there's some portability, right? So if you deploy your environment virtualized in these guest formats, you can port them to different hardware chassis as your servers come off lease or are retired from a capital or support perspective. So easy portability means you can just copy those VHD files or your equivalent, right, depending on your hypervisor platform, and you'll have or migrate to a different hardware platform without having to do installs, reinstalls, and moving users. So other sorry, let me, I'm still on benefits here, where am I? There we go. Other aspects, right, are around deployment times. As we said, first of all, you'll get your guests faster, but in general, there's the concept of server to admin ratios, right? We have fewer physical devices inside of our data centers, therefore we have less hardware to support, we have fewer things that can go wrong, there's operational efficiencies. I could spend probably an hour talking about benefits of virtualization. You could probably get that in another session from the Hyper-V or VMware or Citrix guys as well, so I won't go through all, but in general, you're aware there's significant benefits. The catch to that, though, right, is that there's also some considerations or challenges around virtualization. Now, we can kind of summarize all of this by saying that these challenges are related to sharing, right? So if we go back 30 years, we had mainframes and we had time sharing, and one of the reasons we moved away from that is when we do sharing, we're dependent on other workloads. And so when we have other workloads running, if they're consuming all of the CPUs, our environment or our workloads aren't going to be able to obtain that, and we'll see a reduced performance or some sort of negative impact from a service perspective. So what we've done over the next couple slides is try to lay out what are some of these challenges and what to be aware of. So as you go through planning, it's not a black box, right, but it's something that you'll have some clear insight to. The first one is around the guest core count. So we'll have hardware sizing, talking about how many cores you need for either your front-end, back-end servers or your director/ed servers. You'll then go to your hypervisor vendor or your hypervisor environment, and you'll request some guests, right, with those cores themselves. Some hypervisors have limits, right? So in 2008 R2, we had a limit of 4 cores, so you couldn't provision a guest with more than 4 cores. Other vendors have, we'll say, practical limits, right? So there's logical limits, which might say 8 cores or 16 cores, but then there's practical ones which say, well, even though we support up to 8, we find that for performance reasons, we really cap out at 6, right? And so you might be provisioning a guest with 8, but you'll see that the guest with 8 cores actually has less performance than the same guest that has 6 cores due to the way their code base operates. So there's some investigation at the hypervisor level. There's a very common one that 6 to 8 is probably the one that, I won't mention any names, right? But talk to your vendor to find out what that actual recommended limit is versus the actual published one or documented logical limit. The other, or another common one is around all of your guests in the pool, right, on the same physical server. So if I deploy Link Enterprise Edition and I have 3 front-end servers in my pool, the goal of those front-end servers is to provide availability in the case of a failure. If all 3 of those guests run on the same virtual or same physical host, and that physical host goes down, my link service goes down as well. So when I'm carving out the locations, I want to be aware of the fact that I should balance my link front ends, right, or my link availability across my back end host availability as well. We also have a support stance there that says you cannot mix physical and virtual inside of a pool. So we don't support having 1 physical and 2 virtual, or some combination of physical and virtual inside of the same pool. A pool is either all physical or a pool is all virtual. Another aspect is that we recommend that all of your guests be sized the same. If you have some guests, let's say 2 front ends in the pool have more capacity than the third one, Link is not aware of that. So Link doesn't know how to balance user traffic among the servers in a pool if the servers are sized differently. It won't put 2/3 of the traffic on the servers that have more capacity than the server that has less. So we want all servers in the pool to be sized equally. So not only would we say sized equally, but we wouldn't want one of those servers in the pool to be on a hypervisor farm that has heavy load, right, and the other servers in the pool to be on a farm that has light load. Anytime we have traffic go to the one that has heavy load on that pool or on that farm, we're going to see some performance issues there. We already mentioned the issues around quick migration, live migration, vMotion style technologies. We have it here for reference there, same topic as I discussed back earlier. Another issue with hypervisors today is that there's no capability to do what we call resource segmentation or resource isolation for all 4 core resources. So we need some processor, we need some RAM, we need some network, and we need some storage. There are varying degrees of resource segmentation and isolation for a subset of those. So CPU, for example, right? Most hypervisors can limit the number of CPUs or cores, essentially, that you can assign to a guest. But we have no way of guaranteeing throughput to storage or throughput to network. We're starting to see some of the ones around network, but we don't have firm guarantees on that typically from a hypervisor you're buying today. As a result, this means that other guests that run in your virtual environment can have a negative impact on length. So if you have a Oracle database or a SQL database or Exchange, right, and all of a sudden it starts to go through some heavy load, and on that same physical server there are some link guests, and one of those other guests decides to do a large network transaction, meanwhile you've got some link conference activity occurring, you will see degraded link conference activity, right? So when we share, and we don't have a way to guarantee link a certain amount of bandwidth through that hypervisor interface, we will see some risk or potential there of reduced performance and link. We talked about the hypervisor overhead. That's going to range. The ranges we see today are around 6 to 12%. We usually use 10 as the rule of thumb. But talk to your hypervisor specifically for guidance there. They'll tell you what that overhead is for sizing. Root partitions. If you're running Windows Server, for example, there's the concept of the root partition and the guest partition. The only applications we support in the root would be the concept of your hygiene, sort of antivirus or systems management type software. We don't want to have a Windows Server that has Exchange or SQL installed at the host and then has Link installed as the guest itself inside of that. Storage-wise, we recommend that the storage is either fixed disk or pass-through storage. The rationale behind that is when we use the dynamically expanding disks, every time that disk expands, there's a little bit of overhead taken up both from a CPU perspective and a storage perspective, and that can cause a delay for all, and not just Link, right, but for all other guests running on that physical host. So from a Link perspective, we want those storage aspects to be fixed disks or passed through. That ensures that we don't have this growth problem in terms of a performance penalty. No support for dynamic memory today. As I said, that's going through the testing processes right now, so we might have a revised story later, but in general, that's not there now. We had an active thread internally at Microsoft, and I think this one kind of summarized it. You'll see from some of the virtualization or hypervisor vendors, right, it runs better virtually. And if you think about it, that really can never be true, right, because when I'm running a hypervisor, I've got several more million lines of code between my application and the processor and the core infrastructure itself. So anytime we have virtualization, we're going to see this overhead layer when we want to account for that when we plan for the physical host that contains all the guests, as we showed you back with the overhead of the virtualization itself. So let's look at the CPU components, right? One of the options from a hypervisor vendor is the concept of oversubscription of CPUs. So if I have a physical host that has 48 cores, for example, I could provision typically hundreds of cores on that physical host. That would be called oversubscription, right? We're assigning more resources to the guests on that host than are physically available in the box itself. For Link, right, we want to make sure that we're not oversubscribed, so we want to look at all of the guests on that host itself and ensure that we have enough CPU capacity for all those guests plus some CPU capacity for the hypervisor itself. So if we've got 24 cores on the host, right, we shouldn't have more than around 21 or 22 cores assigned to all the guests. That ensures we have appropriate CPU capacity from the Link environment itself. We talked a little bit about this earlier. Placement of guests, we want those to be distributed as well. We should be able to take out any of your physical hosts at any point in time, but not take down an entire Link pool, right, if we're using the Enterprise Edition front-end pool model. That ensures that we can have both routine maintenance as well as unexpected hardware outages. Those are still the most likely cause of a failure or outage in an environment. Hardware is... we treat as a commodity from the Microsoft perspective. We expect you to have disk failures, chassis failures, motherboard failures. We expect you to be patching once a week, right? All of those require some outage, and we have designed software such as Link to ensure that when you have a random outage or a planned outage in the organization, the service itself stays healthy, but by ensuring users fail over to another available node. If all of your link nodes are running on the same hypervisor host, we're not going to have that availability come through. This statement kind of summarizes the risk of virtualization, right? So with Link, we've got these real-time workloads, audio, video, conferencing, right? That require real-time access to processor memory, network, and storage. If these components are shared and Link does not have access to that when it needs it, you will see degraded experience, could be, and you know, been on calls where it sounds like that, right? So people, end users will notice that right away. They'll call you, they'll say Link is having a problem. Was it Link? It's hard to say, right? Link is, if we go back in time, like 10 years ago, I used to make the joke in organizations that Exchange was the world's best network analyzer. If you had a problem on your network somewhere, right, people would call the help desk immediately because they couldn't get their mail, especially the days before cached mode, right? Before there was cached mode, if you lost connectivity to the server, you couldn't get to your calendar, you couldn't get to your mail, they alerted you very rapidly. Since then, Link has surpassed that, right? Mail is not real time. If you have a telephone call or a conference, just the slightest interruption in service from a network perspective causes a very noticeable end user experience. If you deploy Link, you'll be spending quite a bit of time doing troubleshooting at the network layer. This includes your cabled devices, right? So your switches and routers and your WAN, or MPLS providers. This also includes wireless, right? We're seeing a lot of activity and discussion around how do we optimize for wireless. Our point being, if you're designing Link and deploying it to be your PBX replacement or your phone type solution, you'll spend quite a bit of time troubleshooting on the network side. If you add in an improperly sized or planned virtual environment, you're also going to spend quite a bit of time planning and troubleshooting on the virtualization side, right? In this scenario, you will deploy Link on this hypervisor farm. The hypervisor farm folks will tell you that you've got 8 cores and 12 gigs of RAM and everything that you requested. What they probably won't tell you is that they've oversubscribed CPU, they're using dynamic memory, right? They've turned on some of these additional sharing aspects. And when there's a performance problem, you'll get the report after the fact. You'll go to the hypervisor folks, they're gonna launch Perfmon, they go, oh, look, the farm is running fine. But what they can't show you, right, or what they might have difficulty showing you is an hour ago when this problem occurred, there was another guest on that farm that was running at high utilization and caused some issues with Link. So when you're sharing extensively, it adds to your Link troubleshooting. It means that you're not just going to be troubleshooting on the network side, right? You're also going to be involving another team at the hypervisor layer to do some analysis of what happened there. The last sentence, right? The analysis of physical and virtual guests later may show normal ops. It's only the periods of high utilization. If you've done troubleshooting from a storage area network perspective in the past, you know how this is. It's actually very identical with network. The problem is never them until you prove it to be them, right? Which requires additional effort on your side to sort of show that the problem is actually on the storage area network or on the hypervisor side or on the network side. So, concept of HA, DR, and talking about the different types of roles. We mentioned this concept of bricks. So with Link 2013, the front-end server role, we've tried to move or consolidate the services there. We're even moving some of the back-end portions. We've covered that in some of the architecture ones prior. To optimize or to improve, essentially, the failover experience when we lose any specific node, right? We want you to have a simpler deployment method where the servers are close, if not identical, and so you can lose any one of those at any given point in time, but still not lose it. From a back-end perspective, our recommendation is SQL mirroring. We had a SQL support stance that didn't have the highest clarity when we announced Link 2013. We said if you had Link 2010 and you had SQL mirroring and you upgraded to Link 2013, we'd still support you with SQL clustering. We'd still support you with clustering. But if you deployed a new instance of Link 2013, we didn't support SQL clustering, right? So it was kind of, well, what if I deploy Link 2010 and then go to Link 2013? It was an approach that needed some clarity. We came back and said we support SQL clustering for Link 2013. The support stance there was never something that there was a problem with clustering. It's really around us trying to move people away from anything that has a single point of failure. If we rely on SQL clustering, There's a single point of failure at storage. If that storage becomes unavailable, the entire pool is unavailable. If you use SQL mirroring, we have two unique independent copies. We can have a failure of either node in the mirror, right? But that's not going to affect link because the other node in the mirror will handle the operation. So we support both mirroring and clustering now. We recommend mirroring from an availability perspective. And those can be virtualized, right? We're not requiring those to be physical at the link perspective. And then finally, from a pool perspective, we've also done some amazing work from a pool failover. And we're going to talk a little bit more about this one on the front end characteristics around that, right? Of whether you should deploy standard edition or enterprise edition from a pool capacity. And when we're talking about pools, right, we can have one pool that's physical and one pool that's virtual. It's inside of the pool that we require all nodes or all members to be the same. So let's talk a little bit more about the network side from hypervisors. Hypervisors have also, as I mentioned, done a lot of work around virtualizing network components and giving you some options from the guest layer of what can be done there. I'm going to be listing typically the Windows Server names or what we name the technology, right? You might have to translate that to your third-party hypervisor component. But we have components such as SRV.io that allows the guests to have near-native access to the network interface. And this is especially relevant when we're talking about things such as real-time codecs. It means that we just have less code base, right, between when a packet hits that network interface and when that packet gets some CPU time. So we definitely recommend that because Link is very, very reliant on the network. We want there to be as minimal overhead or buffer between packets hitting that network interface and getting that CPU time that they need. Hyper-V also has this third-party extensible switch that allows some filtering, capturing, and forwarding extensions. In this case, we should not leverage that, and I'm looking at that. I don't know why the recommend column set to yes there. Let's fix that. I don't, no matter how many times we look at these, there's always one that misses your attention. I apologize for that. So the extensible switch, we do not recommend that because if we are adding the extensible switch, right, we're essentially contradicting what we have in SRV.io, which is minimizing the amount of code that that packet has to transverse before it gets that CPU time. There is something called VM queuing. There are specific Intel and Broadcom chipsets where that's possible. We do recommend that. That essentially also is one of the optimizations that's going to decrease the time for those packets to get the CPU time. Offloading the VM chimney or TCP offload, we did see a lot of issues when these were first introduced a few years ago. However, this has been largely addressed by Windows Server 2012. So if we're on an older version of Windows Server, we typically would recommend that the VM chimney capabilities were turned off. However, with Windows Server 2012, we have modified our guidance on that one. Why did my clicker fail? Come on. It's thinking. So here's our additional guidance there, right? So not supported with the software-based NIC teaming. If you want to see the status of that, here's the net sh commands, which will give you additional guidance on the VM queuing or the chimney offload, right, with the teaming capabilities. If you have a third-party hypervisor, we recommend following their guidance. The principle from the link perspective, right, is to try to minimize any additional network interaction filters or throughputs in that virtual switch. We want the network packets from when it hits the network card to get CPU time to be as rapid as possible. So if there's a functionality or feature in your hypervisor that enables or reduces that transversal time, we want that turned on. If there's a feature that adds some filters or policies or something else, right, we want that turned off because that's going to potentially degrade the link experience. And now I've got a clicker that seems to have stopped. All right. IPsec, there are certain NICs, right, that support IPsec offload that can take that load from the CPU and actually run the IPsec analysis on the NIC itself. We say yes. That's assuming, right, that the NIC has the capacity or the capability to handle that IPsec type traffic. As I mentioned, some of the hypervisors are starting to put into place this sort of resource segmentation, resource isolation, right? So here in Hyper-V, there's the QoS minimum bandwidth. We call it fair share, which ensures that a guest has a minimum amount of network bandwidth. We definitely want this because obviously that's going to ensure that if other guests start to consume high network activity, right, the hypervisor is going to guarantee, or guarantee is a strong word, going to prioritize or determine that the link traffic still is going to have a minimum amount of bandwidth to ensure it's going through. 1 gig NICs and 10 gig NICs, we've got some more guidance around this one. But in this case, the when possible, we do like to go to 10 gig NICs. The big one here is around application sharing. I had some questions in some of the other, or posts on some of the other link sessions that we've had around, are there any optimizations for app sharing with Link 2013? Our app sharing and desktop sharing is using RDP as the core protocol, which means that we're reliant on the desktop resolution and pixel depth. What you may have noticed, right, is that there's a lot of, or a larger number of laptops, and especially desktops now, that have some extremely high resolutions, right? So we're saying it's not uncommon to see 2500 by 1600 or multiple monitor support on these. What this means is when you send that screen of pixels right across the network, there's a very bursty initial send of that. And if it's just a static screen, such as a slide like this, there's a burst followed by very minimal packet activity on the network. But that burst can be intense. And so if we have large numbers of application sharing or desktop sharing sessions, and it's in a conference, the server's responsible for that, we need that capacity to be able to absorb those bursts. And so having 10 gig NICs, right, or multiple 1 gig NICs, especially in a shared host perspective where there's other guests running as well, helps enable that we have the bandwidth to accommodate some of these bursts with the large application or with the app slash desktop sharing. Things that can make it worse, right, is so on my animations, I'm just going slide and it shows one slide to the next without any fancy transition effects. If you're adding those transition effects in your sharing session, right, that's obviously going to increase dramatically the number of pixels that are being sent across the wire, and you'll see a reduced performance or a performance penalty essentially in NIC. So guidance, right, around 1 gig and 10. If we have 1 gig, we need at least one for the virtual machines, one for the physical host. You might want to increase that number again, right? If you've got lots of network consumption guests running on that physical host, or if you're doing some large application sharing or AV conferences. Essentially, if you expect high link bandwidth, right, and we've got an excellent link bandwidth calculator to help you estimate that, we're going to have to increase the NICs. If you have 10 gigs or 10 gig NICs, right, you might want to look at some VLANs to segment out your traffic. We don't want to enable the management OS to share the NIC with the guest. We want that 10 gig NIC dedicated to the guests right on there, and a separate network interface dedicated for the host management and the host interfaces themselves. In Hyper-V, this is where you're choosing that option, right? So allow management operating system to share this adapter, we would say should be unchecked, and you have a separate adapter that the management and operating system is using for its network connectivity. Processor-wise, right? We mentioned the concept of the hypervisor overhead. You now know how to calculate that, size your guests using the same guidance as we use for physical, and then add the overhead that your virtualization or hypervisor vendor gives you for the CPU portion itself. We've started a recommendation process this year at Microsoft saying that what we're noticing is that as organizations deploy Link in a virtualized environment, and as these virtualized environments went from a few servers that were dedicated maybe to Link that just happened to be virtualized to these larger virtualization farms running lots of different hosts and applications, we recommend running stress performance testing. This is the trust but verify, right? So you're going to request some guests from your hypervisor farm. Those guests will come back provisioned as exactly as you requested, some number of cores, some amount of RAM, some amount of network. But until you simulate load against those, you really have no idea if that farm is able to back up what those guests have been provisioned to. So we have the Link 2013 stress and performance tool set, which will simulate the traffic, right, and allow you to sort of validate. So build your Link environment on that, on the farm, run the stress and performance tools, and you'll be able to know, did they provision the, even though they provisioned the guests appropriately, is there oversubscription or are there other applications on there that might cause you performance issues once you run your full link load on that environment itself? So from our perspective, if you engage Microsoft, we're starting to take a firmer stance essentially on if you have this large farm environment, let's run a stress and analysis tool set against that after we design it to make sure that the guests that were provisioned have the appropriate capability, connectivity, and throughput. Memory, as we said, no dynamic memory sharing, right? And that's going to be at the hypervisor host level itself. It's not something that we turn on or off for each individual guest. We want those link guests, if they're allocated 12 gigs of RAM, to have 12 actual gigs of RAM, not 12 gigs of RAM shared between some additional guests on that platform. From a storage perspective, right? File formats, we want the, we already know a fixed disk or pass-through storage, right? We want those to be formatted with NTFS. We say fixed or pass-through disks. We don't want the dynamically expanding ones. There are some hypervisors that provide options for storage mobility, being able to move storage around. We turn that off because obviously moving the storage around dynamically is going to have a negative impact while Link is running. Same process for data deduplication. In Windows Server 2012 Hyper-V and some other third-party ones, there's an option for data dedupe. That takes an overhead both at the storage perspective and at the CPU perspective, therefore meaning you'll have a degraded Link experience such as conferencing or audio. So we don't have heavy storage requirements in Link in the first place, so we don't see a significant benefit, but we would see a potential user experience degradation right when we see that. Quick migration, live migration, we already covered. That's not supported on it. Host OS software, don't install anything there. And then finally, auto-tuning. What we're seeing on the larger farms, right, is the concept of using some tuning at the hypervisor level to automatically sort of port guests around or adjust memory requirements or CPU requirements based on the actual usage of those guests. We want those turned off because we've sized Link for a certain hardware or physical capacity, and we want it to run at that level. This brings up, I meant to bring this up earlier as we talked about sizing and this concept of the two socket, eight core server chassis. When we give you our sizing guidance, that guidance takes a user model. We've showed you there's a defined user model on TechNet that says here's the percentage of IM, you know, users in an IM conversation, users in a conference, using having audio call, using having video call, users having some sort of web conferencing. If you take that, if your users fall in that ratio, right, and you have that a certain number of users, we will target each front-end server in that platform. When we talk about the 6,500 users per front-end server for enterprise or 2,500 front-end users for physical or for standard, to run at about 70% utilization, right? So we are using that extra 30% because at times you will deviate from that normal user model and you'll have a couple of extra conferences, or you'll have a conference that has HD, some conferences that have HD video, or you'll see a burst as a screen sharing request has a high pixel count. So when we size, we don't size Link to run at 90% of your CPU. We size Link to run at 70, and we keep that other 30% to account for spikes in traffic. If your hypervisor notices that Link is always running at 70 and decides to reduce the capacity to Link, right, so that's more like 90, you don't have this capacity to absorb spikes, and anytime you have excessive traffic, which will happen regularly, right, you will have a degradation of the end user experience. So we want 70, and we want that extra capacity there for the spikes in traffic that will inevitably occur, so therefore we turn off that auto-tuning capacity. We talk about this workload management, right? So Link, when we schedule a conference, we have this concept of, in the code base, we call it the focus and focus factory, and that accepts the conference initiation. So the first person that clicks on the join link, we talk to focus, right? It's going to go out and find all the servers in the pool that have conferencing capabilities, and then choose one of those servers natively, right? So we're going to load balance the conferences among the servers in the pool. What we're not aware of is if, like I said, you've got different hardware capacity and the different servers in the pool. If so, we're still going to load balance, assuming that all the servers are identical. And so we don't want the guests and Link to be different sizes in the pool. Link is not going to be aware if the hypervisor is changing either dynamically or we've got different sizes, right, on those workloads itself. If we have that, we'll get some bad workload management decisions. We want that decision logic, right, or the framework that we have in Link to work effectively and ensure that no matter which server the conference is provisioned on, users will have a good experience on that conference. All right. Questions on virtualization? I think I spent about an hour running through that one. I know it was relatively quick. I didn't see too many hands go up on that. Yes?
Quick question on the SBI.
Yes.
Can that be virtualized yet?
Question is, can an SBA or SBA or an SBS?
I should click. SBI.
Yes. So question is, can an SBA be virtualized? An SBA, by definition, is half Link, so a Link server running as a registrar for those endpoints. The other half is the hardware component, which would be your PRI interface or SIP trunk or something. So we can't virtualize the PRI side, right? So an SBA can't because we have that hardware side. There's the way you'd virtualize it is we use something called an SBS. So an SBS is a survivable branch server, which could run as a VM at that location and provides the registrar half of an SBA, and you'd pair it with a traditional hardware gateway. So you could run a virtualized SBS with a gateway, or you'd run an SBA, which has the SBS and gateway together.
Yeah. I think where I was coming from is the only direct SIP provider in Australia is MyNetPhone, I think.
Okay.
So with the SBA, it'd be like to sort of, we could start to push them to, because I mean, if we're doing a SIP trunk, there's no reason why they couldn't do their gateway as virtualized, really.
So yeah, okay, yep, yep. So. Yep, so question is really saying, like, if my provider doesn't have PRIs, right, my provider's already switched to data and I want to go SIP into Link itself, at that point, we wouldn't say you would even deploy an SBA or SBS. What we would say is an SBC or session border controller. If you're, does that provider require an SBC or could they go straight to Link? Pardon? Well, yep. So if the provider requires an SBC, you'd run an SBC. That would be your firewall, essentially, right, from that provider to your Link environment. Some providers will let you go right to Link directly, in which case you don't even need the, there's only one, yep. In general, they want that SBC functionality to sort of segment off their traffic. But you wouldn't need the gateway, the concept of the SBA is really there to provide the PRI interface. So if you had a provider with a SIP trunk coming in, have that come into your Link environment and have a SBS or Survivable Branch server, which could be a virtualized device on it. So the SBS is the link half of the SBA.
So there's no difference between the SBS and the SBI, really?
The only difference is that it's one device versus two devices, right? Yep. So question is, what's the difference between an SBA and an SBS? The SBS is the link half of an SBA, right? So if you add an SBS plus a gateway, you have a SBA. If you buy an SBA, you get those in one chassis. So that's the only difference there. Link 2013 Standard Edition. What we found, right, over the last 6 months to a year or so as Link 2013 has been out, is this concept of organizations reevaluating the concept of enterprise. And so as we look at physical and virtual, right, and we'll show you a slide next to talk about some of the server counts, we're seeing more of an option of let's just deploy Standard Edition pools for all of our users and pair them. Right, because a paired Standard Edition pool now comes very close to providing the level of availability that an Enterprise Edition pool does without having the SQL backend and some of the other infrastructure required around it. We don't need hardware load balancers because we only have one server per pool, so we don't have to load balance the HTTPS traffic because there aren't more than one server per pool. No SQL Server backend, right? We're still running SQL Express on those front-end servers, but it's handling all the SQL functionality. No DFS file share. If something fails, the most that fails is a single pool, right, which is a subset of our user population. So we have, if I deploy, for example, 4 Standard Edition servers and 2 paired pools, and I lose one of those and I had 4,000 people spread across them, the most that are impacted are 1,000, and they have a failover to the other pair or the other Standard Edition server inside of that. The next graph kind of shows the breakout even for very large organizations. I'll get to that in a moment. And when we put the users on there, in general, when we talk about this brick model, we try to move away from the 100% zero, right, or the active-passive type model, to the 50-50 model. And the reason we like this concept of 50-50 is that in the case of an outage, half of the people are completely unimpacted, and the other half have some impact, right? So you as an admin kind of determine what those levels are. But what it means is that in that failure mode, you don't have all the users going through the recovery process. Half of them are okay. Half of them, you'll require some administrator operations there. We've also made some functional changes inside of Link itself. We used to have, for voice routing, some pool dependencies around that. But now we have this concept of selective trunks. And so it doesn't require the mediation servers to be specific to that pool, right, or to be in a pool themselves. We can have those trunks that are available on the selective aspect itself. So, and I keep forgetting that my clicker died there. What's triggered this, right, is even internal, we've noticed when you start to look at even very large organizations, right, up to the 40, 50,000 mark, you can deploy a Link environment with Standard Edition that requires fewer servers than Enterprise Edition. So when we're down in the 10 to 40,000 user counts, right, we're seeing fewer Standard Edition servers required to support the overall load than if we do Enterprise Edition with SQL and mirroring and all the other components required around that. So as a result, you have a brick model, right? All the servers are configured identically. We have a simple deployment model, and we have an impact when there's an outage that's going to be less than that in the Enterprise Edition scenario. We have some guidance. Obviously, you want to use the what we call site-based federation routes. You and I are going to cover some more detail around these aspects in the HADR session, but we wanted to highlight this one here as well. For the SRV records, we just create some different weights for each one of the pools associated with it. We do need an external web farm FQDN for each one, and a wildcard certificate on reverse proxy makes it easier to add or remove those pools internally. Caveats to that, right, is you will have an increased RTO, RPO time. That is because there is some administrator intervention required, as we'll talk to. There is a manual pool switchover. We have to type the invoke CS pool failover. However, once we invoke that, the people who are on the failed pool will re-register and have all their functionality on the other pool inside of the organization. There's a change if the next hop from Edge turns out to be the pool that went down. We might have to change that, right? Response groups associated with that would have a manual switchover assigned there. Where do we assign users, right? Well, let's say we had six pools in the organization. We want those users to be split up. There's some anticipation or planning of how to break that out. Theoretically, you could say more complex to manage because of the top five bullets. However, there's the corollary of we don't have hardware load balancers, we don't have SQL, right? We reduce some administration on that side as well. And there's your PSTN conference DID is going to be associated with a single pool. If it's a Standard Edition, right, that's a single server, single point of failure. And same concept for OA, as that also points to the pool level. Sizing and managing tools. We told you about the planning tool. I think you're already aware about that, so I won't spend a significant amount of time. We've added a lot of capability in Link 2013, including the support for virtualization. Go through it. Remember, it's going to estimate conservatively. You'll have great firewall port, certificate, and DNS guidance out of the planning tool. You might need to reevaluate the server count that it provides or does as part of the feedback. Topology builder, we have added functionality there as well, right, around SQL mirroring and paired pools. Office web apps are all new from the Link 2010 side. Those exist in Link 2013 and will make it easier for your planning. So with that, I think I just saw the 5-minute sign left. Any other questions regarding planning or virtualization? Yes. Oh, and sorry, I forgot to give out the virtualization question back there.
You're welcome.
Thanks. Yes.
For some reason, I thought wildcard certificates weren't supported, but you mentioned that.
Yes. Question is wildcard certificate and support. There was a period of time where we didn't have a support stance around wildcard certificates, but we do support wildcard certs on Edge or reverse proxy solutions with Link. There's the support stance comes to, if we go back far enough, there were some mobile devices that had issues with wildcard certificates. That essentially by now has been cleared up, right? So current shipping mobile device OSs are aware of the concept of wildcard certificates, but if you have some older mobile devices, you might see some issues. You're welcome.
Server, virtual guest, co-located with the VM, that's right, frame.
Yeah, so question is, any issues with having a persistent chat server on the same physical host as a front-end server? Not if you follow the guidance of sizing each guest and then adding the hypervisor overhead, right? So as long as you do that, you can run, you will run your virtual environment identical to a physical environment, right? Because we're ensuring at that point that we have enough resources. Whenever the areas where we see resource contention and virtualization is where we oversubscribe CPU or we oversubscribe memory, and now the guests don't have the actual physical underlying resources that they need when they need it during a conference or some other aspect. So as long as you're sizing properly, you will see the same performance in a virtual link environment as a physical link environment. Question?
So SQL
is which versions of SQL compatible with Link 2013? Up through SQL 2012. And question is which SQL backend versions are supported with Link 2013? I'd have to look to confirm, but off the top of my head, it's SQL 2008 R2, SQL 2012, and I believe we're in testing support right now for SQL 2012 R2. So that's not on there, but would be coming at, expected to be coming, I should say. There could be a problem we wouldn't, but I'm assuming that will be, testing will come through as okay.
Would that mean support SQL always on?
Yeah, so the question is around SQL always on. I don't have a comment on that right now. That question has come up a lot, and I should have put it on the slide or on the deck as we're working on it. I don't know what the answer will be. All right. Well, thank you all. Thanks again. Appreciate your time.